many of you remember this this movie? The Sound of Music was a movie that got the Christian Reformed Church back into movie theaters. It's the story of an Austrian sea captain who the Nazis were trying to pressure into service with the German Navy. And it's based on a true story. He was a widower and had a large family. And so Austria being a fairly Catholic country, he looked to the convent to send a young woman who was in the process of becoming a nun to come and care for the children. And of course, it's a movie version, so they take some liberties, but they fall in love. And this is a Roger and Hammerstein's musical. If you remember, in the middle of the 20th century, Rogers and Hammerstein, they had all these musicals. And in the middle of the movie, or towards the end, when finally Fräulein Maria and the sea captain are falling in love, there's this little song called Something Good. And in this song, there's the line that's basically, somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. And I remember seeing this as a kid in the movie theaters. It would be on TV. My parents had the musical album. And I never understood the song. I was like, what's this song about? Somehow I must have done something good. Well, as you get a little bit older, you get a little more acquainted with the world. It's like, oh, I get it. This is karma, or common religion. Common religion basically says, if you do good, you'll receive good. And if you do evil, you'll receive evil. Now, we've been talking about this Emil Durkheim idea of a social fact. This was a common assumption that nobody questioned throughout much of human history, that God or the gods or the universe or something was the enforcer of justice in the world. Now, on one level, we understand natural consequence. If I eat poorly, don't take care of my body, there'll be health issues. If I eat well, take care of my body, I'll feel better. It's generally speaking what we know. But this pervasive idea, this social fact, was all over the place, and you run into it in the book of Job. In the book of Job, the story has the best man you might imagine. Job is both proficient in public justice and in personal piety. The book says that in public justice, Job was at the gates of the city, and that tended to be where justice was laid out. He would give to the poor, and he would protect the fatherless and the homeless. So in terms of public justice, Job was a man of high standing who looked out for the needs of the vulnerable and the poor. And in terms of private piety, every morning Job made sacrifices for his children, lest they had sinned the night before. And in all of his ways, Job was upright. He was the best man in the world. And then calamity struck. Bandits came and drove off his herds. A whirlwind came and collapsed a herd. You might think of it like a tornado. Collapsed the house. He lost his children. He lost his wealth. He lost his riches. And everyone said, we know how the world works. Do good things, you're blessed. Do bad things, you're cursed. Job must have done something wrong for all of this calamity to befall him. And so what you can see in this little drawing of Job, his three friends are pointing fingers at him. Job, there's a secret sin that caused this. And even Job's wife is looking up at him and saying, Job, curse God and die. And in all of this, Job said, there is no secret sin. I maintain my innocence. And the whole book of Job is about that drama. Now, things have changed in the last 500 years. Social facts have changed dramatically. Now, if a hurricane strikes or an illness befalls, we say this is the product of natural cause and effect. Last week, we saw Paul and Luke on a ship bound for Rome that is carried away and destroyed by a storm. An angel tells Paul that God will send him to Rome. And as a gift from God to Paul, all the rest of the crew members will be saved. Now, modern egalitarians hear that and say, well, a gift? That sounds offensive. And so I'll say, would you rather they all die? Well, no, but okay, so what exactly are you complaining about in the story? Well, once safely on shore, we, Luke and Paul, and the rest of the people who were on the ship, found out that the island was called Malta. The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold. So you can think about, yeah, somebody must have done something bad. Not only do they survive the shipwreck, but they get up on the beach and the weather's lousy. So they're there and shivering, freezing wet. So the people who lived on the island made fires so that they could start to warm themselves. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fashioned itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, that shows that the snake got a good bite, got those venoms right in his hand, they said to each other, "This man must be a murderer. Though he escaped from the sea, the goddess Justice has not allowed him to live." Now, if you in school ever read the Iliad or the Odyssey, you'll be familiar with this way of thinking, that the gods during the Iliad are all playing sides on the great war between the Greeks and the Trojans. And in the Odyssey, Odysseus, who's the cleverest of all of the Greeks, has to make his way home. And the god Poseidon is against him. And various gods and goddesses are always sort of vying for him, trying to help him or trying to hurt him. And Odysseus is crafty. And so the people of Malta thought, this Paul must be like Odysseus. He's really crafty. He saved himself from Poseidon, the god of the sea. Ah, but goddess Justice is after him. So surely, like Job, he must have done something evil, because the poor guy escapes a shipwreck and is only now brought down by a viper. Now, modern people read this and have a whole variety of thoughts. One of them usually is, people back then were superstitious. Oh, is it superstition that most of the time you sow what you reap? It's not superstitious at all. If the doctor says, lose weight, get more exercise, stop smoking, eat better, we all say, yes, that's true. That's very true. Is that superstition? It's basically what the islanders were saying. Modern people today know better. Do we really? Just because the doctor says to do all of these things, do we actually do them? Do people get bit by snakes today? All the time. Do you know, and I know, snakes better than they did? My guess is most of us here know a lot less about snakes than the people on that island. They lived on them all the time. They knew snakes very well. What do you mean by know? Well, I know about snakes, but if you actually live with a snake, you know a lot more about snakes, and so they probably knew a lot better. The people of Malta could figure out by this sign that Paul was on a mission from God. The people of Malta would come to that conclusion and will, well, it's going to get a little funny in a minute, but Paul was on a mission from God. It's just Paul's conception of God was different from theirs. Now, in last week's sermon, we talked about Jonah's storm. Jonah, of course, fled from God, and a great storm came on the sea, and Jonah says to the sailors, throw me in and the sea will be calm. The sailors don't want to do that because they kind of understand competing gods, and they're like, well, if we throw you in, maybe we'll satisfy the god of the sea, but there might be other gods out there that are angry with us for taking your life. So Jonah finally prevails upon them, and they throw him into the sea, and the sea becomes calm. In Jesus' storm, Jesus stands up and stills the storm, and the disciples are terrified. There's another interesting story in the New Testament of a man born blind. This is from John chapter 9. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. Now pay attention to this business from birth, because maybe if you're 20 or 30 or 40 and you become blind, someone would say, well, you know, he became blind because he was sinning. And usually the blindness must somehow be connected with the sin. But this guy was blind from birth. A few years ago, there was a rather famous Dutch soccer coach who was enamored by Hindu religion. And so he liked to make public statements since he had a platform, because he was a soccer coach and everybody loves soccer in the Netherlands. And he just postulated to the Dutch nation, I believe that children born with birth defects are suffering the penalty of justice for wrongs they did in a previous life. The Dutch population didn't like this answer at all, and so discussed it. But this question is around with this sort of form of common religion. And so they bump into a man born blind, so surely this calamity isn't from something he did. He was born that way. So Jesus' disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? It's common religion. Everybody knows this. Neither this man nor his parents sinned. Now, you can twist that statement and say his parents were sinless and he's sinless. It's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying basically what the book of Job says is that it's not that common religion is always wrong, but it's limited. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming, when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And Jesus would often say things like this that kind of make you say, do I quite get what Jesus is saying? But what about the man is pretty clear. Jesus says, he's actually born blind so that you might see something. And you might say, that sounds like a heavy toll. Yeah, it is. Now, this comes out of what a Jewish theologian wrote at the beginning of the 20th century in a fascinating book that I found a couple of years ago called The Religion of Israel. And he basically says that common religion is all around the world. And we sort of know this. But most common religions around the world sort of postulate, they don't use these words, an impersonal meta-divine realm in which the gods of the world vie for control. And that's basically what you see in Homer. In the meta-divine realm in which gods, people, and other spiritual forces like karma, justice, etc., exert their power and are witnessed through the events on the ground. So when Job suffers calamity, surely some sin must have caused it. But Hebrew monotheism doesn't have this meta-divine realm. Hebrew monotheism has God. And God is not impersonal. God is personal. God is picking and choosing. And so when the idea of this man born blind came up, people want to reduce it to common religion and say, somebody sinned. And Jesus says, no, God had a plan for this man's life. Now, the people of Malta participated in common religion. They are interpreting events in a moral universe where there's such thing as bad fortune as a tell of Paul's moral character. Surely he must be a murderer. But now, was Paul a murderer? Didn't he hunt down Christians? So were the people of Malta completely wrong? Not necessarily. And then the Enlightenment comes, and we think, well, there's this long chain of cause and effects. Snakes live in wood piles. Snake reacted to fire and then bit Paul's hand. True. That's true, too. Now, most Christians in the West today are kind of caught in the middle of these things. And so sometimes we sort of blend them. Sometimes we sort of punt. We don't quite know what to do. Snakes do live in wood piles. God is in charge. And how do we hold these competing things together? Now, Paul being bit, the snake is hanging from his hand. He shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall dead because they know these snakes. They're all around them. People get bit by these snakes. They die by these snakes. And so they're little Enlightenment people. They understand cause and effect. Snake bites man. Man dies. So then they watch Paul. He's going to get sick. We all know he's going to get sick. Maybe they took bets. You know, he's going to fall. He's going to get sick tomorrow, maybe in a week. And they watch and watch and watch. And he shows no ill effect. After waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, now they've come to a different conclusion. They've changed their mind and said, he's a god. Oh, this has been a revelatory experience. But Luke is watching this, and the thing is, Luke knows another story where this happened. Happened in the city of Lystra. In Lystra, there was a man who was lame, probably begging by the side of the road. He had been that way, notice, from birth. So you take away who sinned, this man or his parents? No Jesus there, but Paul's there. And he had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Probably listened about the resurrection and began to think, if this God of Paul's rose from the dead, maybe this God of Paul's will help me rise from the mat. So Paul looked directly at him and saw that he had faith to be healed and called out, stand on your feet. And I'm sure everybody else thought, well, Paul's new in town. We all know this guy. He's lame from birth. At that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lyconian language, the gods have come down to us in human form. Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bowls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. So here are Paul and Barnabas, and things are getting out of hand. But when the apostles Paul and Barnabas heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed into the crowd shouting, friends, why are you doing this? We too are only humans like you. We bring you good news telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. They're Hebrews. There's no meta-divine realm of Zeus and Hermes vying for power where I'm on team Zeus, I'm on team Hermes, I'm avoiding Poseidon. None of that. Paul says there's one God and he made everything. In the past, he let all nations go their own way. Yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has showed kindness by giving you rain from heavens and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowds from sacrificing to them. In other words, again, we see this again and again in the book of Acts. You can tell people things, but these social facts are stubborn things. But when some Jews from Antioch and Iconium won the crowd over, they probably said, you heard them, they're frauds, you've been duped. These men are trying to defraud you, to turn you away. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. Wow, there's a turn. One minute they're sacrificing to him that he's a god, and the next minute they think he's a fraud. And so Luke's watching this in Malta thinking, oh, we've been here before. This is a problem. But it went better in Malta. There was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island, and he welcomed us into his home and showed us generous hospitality for 3 days. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went in to see him, and after prayer, placed his hands on him and healed him. And when this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. Now again, it's probably likely that no matter what Paul said or preached, they would all think in terms of their own religion. But there's a little spark of something that was kindled. They honored us in many ways, and when we were ready to sail, they furnished us with the supplies we needed. In other words, not only the illness and the snake, but also the miracles were part of a much larger plan by which God looked after Paul again, and with Paul, everyone on the ship. Now remember the thesis statement of the book of Acts, right there in the first chapter. After Jesus' crucifixion, his resurrection, they're all gathering around Jesus, and his disciples are thinking, maybe now we kick out the Romans. Paul, Roman citizen, is now on his way to Rome to stand trial before Caesar. The disciples then gathered around him and asked, Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? He said to them, it is not for you to know the times or the dates the Father has set by his own authority. The Father already knows. My eyes are on much bigger things than just Judah and Galilee. I haven't come just to release Judeans from Romans. I've come to release the world from their sin. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Now Paul is traveling to the ends of the earth, and he has received power, and in these stories, he is Jesus' witness. This story, in fact, on Malta sounds a lot like Jesus in Galilean towns. Jesus heals someone, and everybody's like, hey, wait a minute, I need some of that too. And so they all come around, and they are healed. Now, again, they're probably not going to be disavowed of their pagan polytheism, but a little light has gone out. Now, Bart Ehrman, who wrote a very interesting book about the triumph of Christianity, where he basically said, well, part of the reason that Christianity conquered the Roman Empire is because miracles happened. Now, the great irony of Bart Ehrman is he doesn't believe in miracles. And so when I look at his book, I think, okay, Rome conquered because there are stories of miracles and Christians were exclusive, but you don't believe in miracles, so was it just stubbornness that conquered the Roman Empire? I don't think so. Seems to be a fatal element in his book. But the miracles very much were a sign of divine favor to common religion. Now, the thing about common religion is that it's not true. Go ahead and do a lot of bad things. See how that goes for you. People learn this in time. They start doing better things. But sometimes it's a little simplistic and sometimes just wrong, like in the case of Job. But here's Paul, and we might think he's going to be like Alexander or Caesar or one of these great people who are going to be wealthy and powerful and rule the world. But like Jesus, Paul is in chains. I don't mean that physically at that point. He's a prisoner. and we don't know whether he will ever not be a prisoner again. We don't quite know the details of the end of Paul's life. He has rescued the lives of the pagan sailors and the soldiers and the prisoners on board the ship. He is on his way to stand trial before Caesar. And everybody will ask, well, how can such a great prophet or a god who can survive a shipwreck and shake off a poisonous snake? Isn't there a snake in the Garden of Eden? You think these stories are arbitrary? How can all of that, how can he then remain chained and become Caesar's victim? And Paul would say, I know someone else who was arrested and executed by Caesar. There's a story going on here that begins to undermine common religion, because according to the rules of common religion, if you do everything right, you'll get everything in return. And this, in fact, if you go to the beginning of the book of Job, before Job's calamity, it started with a little conversation. Satan, the accuser, was running around the world, had a meeting with God. And God says, oh, what do you think? Satan says, you know what? This common religion, people have gamed this system. They're only good because it's mercenary. They're only good because it pays. That's not true goodness. True goodness should be about doing the right thing even when it costs you. And the Lord said, okay, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan said, you're proving my point. He's wealthy. He's blessed. He has beautiful children. He has a wonderful house. He has herds and flocks. He's only good because you've paid him. And God says, strike him. Go ahead. Let's see what happens. The book of Job is kind of a mess. But what about one who came who didn't have any sin at all? And one who came who did nothing wrong? And one who came who was arrested and beaten and executed for nothing he did? What would such a story mean? What if that man were God? What would that story mean? It would mean something important. Now, common religion, science, and natural law, they all major in cause and effect, and they don't go away. But Job, Jesus, and Paul demonstrate that there's more to the story. Israel fails to keep her covenant, but God won't abandon her. The people on Malta were ignorant of God, and in Lystra, but God still gave them rain and sun and joy in their hearts. But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Before Paul ever was confronted with Jesus on the road to Damascus, Jesus died for Paul. Before any of us were born, Jesus died for you. Now, Paul shows that God will deliver him from the sea and the serpent, sort of Genesis 1 and Genesis 3, but he too will take the path of Christ. Now, somewhere in your youth or childhood, you must have done something good. I'm sure both of them did good things in their youth or childhood, and both of them did some bad things too. Now, why they are sort of blessed to be in love, and of course, it's based on a true story, the Von Trapps in Austria will climb over those mountains and make their way to Switzerland, and they will become a Christian singing act. And that's sort of why they became famous. But what if you missed the window? What if you did a lot of bad and not a lot of good? What, in fact, if you were mired in your rebellion so deep you couldn't get out? Common religion says, sorry, you haven't paid the dues, you get nothing. But Jesus, who showed himself master of the storm and the defeater of serpents, Jesus subjected himself to us and bore our twisted notion of justice and became a ransom for many. In Numbers, the Israelites, after their grumbling, were beset by snakes and they're dying, and the Lord and Moses says, "Lord, the snakes." And the Lord says, "Make a bronze serpent and put it on a pole and lift it up. And when the Israelites see it, they won't die from the snake bite." Now, most of us would say, "We'd rather you just got rid of the snakes." And I get that. But there's something that happens when we learn in hardship. There's something happens when we begin our rebellion and we pay a price. Or we pay a price for someone else's evil. There's something that happens. We look to him who became sin so that we might live. Something in us changes. Now, when you receive this, if you work common religion and you see someone who's suffering, it's really easy to say, "Boy, I sure am happy about myself and my moral performance. I had the right parents. I was raised the right way. I was taught right from wrong. I, through much exercise and will, have been able to make the right choices in life, and I have been rewarded for those right choices." Well, good for you. Jesus tells a story of two men went up to the temple to pray, and one said, "I was raised in the right home, I was taught right from wrong, and I've done right. Lord, I thank you, I'm not like that Roman collaborator over there." And then we listen to what that man prays, who snuck into the temple because he didn't want anybody catching him. He says one little thing: "Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner." And Jesus then says the strangest thing. He says, "One man left justified." And common religion says, "Wasn't it the guy who kept all the rules?" And Jesus said, "No, it was the one who looked to God for his righteousness, not to his own moral performance." And if you see that God gives you mercy, forgiveness, and in fact, a new kind of righteousness, what do you say? It's a gift. And if you receive such a gift, how should you live? Well, with courage, because you lost, and God gave you this. With generosity, because everything you have is a gift from God. On a mission, because God himself is on a mission to let the world know who he is. With joy, with hope. That's sort of what this little album cover is about. You have the stern sea captain, and you have the young nun who, in a strange way, seems to be abandoning something religious, but in another way is used by God to bless the world beyond what she could imagine. You see, here's the thing about a gift. If my righteousness is based on my moral performance, I know myself. My moral performance might be good some days, not good other days. But what if it's a gift? And then I can't lose it. Then it's given by God. In Romans 8, Paul says, "Nothing can separate us from the love of God." If you lean into that, then you have something secure. Let's pray. Lord, this world assails us, whether it's storms or cancer or heart disease or poverty or just the normal struggles of this world. And neither Job nor Jesus nor Jonah nor Paul were exempt from those sufferings, and none of us are. And Lord, when we have to undergo them, We need to pray for strength, because so often we don't feel we have the strength to come through. But Lord, you are the giver of life. You show patience and generosity to the sinners of this world. And Lord, when you show us who you are, and when you give us this mercy, you help us, Lord, to have a different kind of strength, not based on our efforts, but based on your grace. May we live in gratitude from that. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen. Would you stand?